This interview is part of an oral history project for the Association for the Rhetoric of Science and Technology. Learn more at arstonline.org.
Can we start by having you just tell us your name, current position, and institutional affiliation?
I'm Leah Ceccarelli, and associate professor at the University of Washington, Communication Department.
And can you talk a little bit about some of your current research related to the rhetoric of science, technology, and medicine?
Sure. I just finished a book called On the Frontier of Science. It's about the metaphor, frontier of science metaphor. And it looks at the public discourse of scientists. One of the things that I think hasn't really been studied that much by rhetoricians of science is the actual orations of scientists, which is kind of ironic because, you know, rhetoric is sort of founded on the idea of studying public speech. And so this book looks at that trope, the frontier trope, in the public address of scientists. And it's going to be published at Michigan State University Press in their Rhetoric and Public Affairs series, which is a series devoted to work in public address research.
Can you give us one example, maybe, of an oration by a scientist where this trope is in play?
The book looks at several examples, but one is a very famous one is the speeches at the press conference at the declaration of the near completion of the Human Genome Project at the White House in 2000. I think that's right. And it was Francis Collins who gave a speech that, and he also helped guide the speech writing for President Clinton's speech at that time as well. And the frontier metaphor really played strongly there. It was a comparison to between the scientists who had just completed or nearly completed the Human Genome Project and Lewis and Clark. And so their genome map was compared to the map that was laid out for President Jefferson laid out before President Jefferson Clinton. So it was a sort of a play on this image. And my argument in the book is that the frontier metaphor as used by scientists really it encourages us to think of science in a particular way, as exploitative, as very masculine, conquering virgin territory, and that there are some problems with thinking about science in this way. It certainly gives scientists a certain heroic cast, a certain heroic ethos, but it also separates scientists from the public. They're like frontiersmen, not fully civilized in the ways of the townsfolk. And so they're both heroes and despised at the same time.
So how did you get into research related to the rhetoric of science?
Well, when I was an undergraduate, I was a biology major. And it was pretty late in my time as a student, as an undergraduate, that I discovered rhetoric. And I just loved it. Rhetoric was just so much more interesting to me than the biology classes. And so by then, it didn't make sense to not finish the biology major. I was pretty much done with it. So I decided to do a double major in rhetoric and biology. Ended up going 5 years on the five-year plan to finish it all up. This was at Berkeley. And what do you do with a double major in rhetoric and biology? Well, become a rhetoric of scientists, focusing on biology. It just sort of made sense.
What can you tell me about the history of ARST and your involvement with it?
So I was a graduate student when ARST first formed, and so I was kind of a fly on the wall at its formation. I was not invited to the initial meeting, just being a graduate student, but I crashed the meeting. I had heard about it from a professor at my university, Tom Goodnight. And so I showed up, I think, at probably the first meeting, and at least the last half of it, and just sort of sat in the back of the room to watch all my heroes talk about this new project that they were going to develop. I don't remember the details. It was a very long time ago, but I do remember sort of being there at the beginning, but as a, I would have just been in the first year of my PhD program at that time.
And are there any memorable moments from some of the meetings you've attended over the years?
Well, I remember the, of course, the Gonker attack. I remember, I think it was the first time he presented that. I remember him talking about the ideas. I think it might have been at that formation meeting of ARST, but I remember the actual, when he actually presented the paper for the first time, and it was in a room that was way too small, and it was filled to overflowing, and there were many people who were coming in and had to leave because there just wasn't any room for them in the room. But I was in the room, scrunched in the room, and so I remember that. My advisor, Mike Leff, had an advanced copy of that critique, and he gave it to me as much for my general exams. Was he gave me Dilip's critique and said, respond to this. That was one of my exams. It was a great exam question. Because, of course, everyone has had to respond to Dilip over the years. And there were, you know, pretty much every conference there was a let's beat up on Dilip panel.
Other memorable moments?
No, I mean, I think there have been times when when it first started, the organization was run by the sort of the leaders in the field, the people whose work I had been reading. And then I think as it progressed, those people moved on and the organization started being run by graduate students. I remember when the Pittsburgh Program in Rhetoric of Science first started. I was a graduate student then, too, and John Palakis was a visiting scholar at Northwestern at the time, and he showed me the flyer, the information on this program, and said, hey, you might want to consider this for your PhD. And I was a master's student at the time. I said, no, I don't. I'm going to stay here. But I ended up sort of attaching myself to the very vital, vibrant community there at Pittsburgh, and would attend Pittsburgh parties, uninvited also, but to hang out with all the Rhetoric of Science graduate students that I knew. And I think at some point, I remember someone years later said, was surprised to find out that I was a student at Northwestern, because he said, I always thought you were a Pittsburgh student. So I guess that there was this, I think, early connection between ARST and Pittsburgh that I think sustained it in sort of a period of time when the senior scholars had sort of dropped out a little bit. And I see the senior scholars coming back, certainly they did for this pre-conference. I think that's something to keep in mind, is the way that there's the graduate students in Rhetoric of Science, especially at Pittsburgh, helped to keep this organization going.
So it is the 20-year anniversary of ARST. Looking back over the last 20 years, what are the significant tensions or intellectual sticking points that kind of stand out to you in the field? Gonkar is one.
Gonkar,
for sure.
Right. There was actually you had asked earlier about memorable ARST conferences. There was the one that John Angus Campbell had organized around intelligent design, which I think eventuated in the Rhetoric and Public Affairs special issue devoted to that issue, to intelligent design, and then to the book that was also published at Michigan State University Press on design and intelligent design in education, rhetorical education. So that was memorable because it was very controversial, I think. I remember Celeste Condit in the audience being somewhat unhappy with the way things were progressing at that meeting. And I sort of shared her disquiet to some degree. Although, of course, John Angus Campbell has been a hero to me and one of my early mentors. He was he had come to also come to Northwestern as a visiting scholar, actually in my very first year there. So I had a chance to take a course on rhetoric of science with John Angus Campbell. And my work with him really started my career. It was the paper I wrote for his class, which became my master's thesis, which was then, you know, further developed into my dissertation, which became my first book. So, yeah, I mean, I think that that's one tension. And I, you know, you see that reflected in my manufactured controversy article that came out, I guess it was a couple of years ago. And I'm continuing to do some work in that subject area, public controversy about science. But it was sort of difficult for me to write that article and come out pretty much against my mentor, John Angus Campbell, and also Steve Fuller, who also was very helpful for me early in my career, but who also has been arguing or had given support to the intelligent design community. So that was, for me, a continuing conflict within the field that I've had a difficult time positioning myself with regards to.
What were some of the biggest challenges early on facing the development of the field? Did you ever have to wade any battles about, you know, why science? And what are some of the biggest challenges you see today going forward in the next 20 years?
I mean, I think at the beginning, the challenge we had was to argue that that science was rhetorical, right? That scientific texts were worthy, both open to rhetorical analysis. I think that was sort of the very early question, and then that it would be a good thing for us to do rhetorical analysis of those texts. But I think that that battle's been fought, right? I mean, I think I don't really see people talking about the rhetoric as epistemic sort of argument anymore that tries to bring science down to a level that it can be analyzed by rhetoric. It's just, I think, understood that just as you can do a rhetorical, you don't just do a rhetorical analysis of speech text, you do a rhetorical analysis of the internet, of movies, and of science, of art. The range of objects covered by rhetorical scholars has really expanded, and there's really no questioning of that anymore. So that was sort of an early concern. I think it's been rested. And then, you know, what is the place of rhetoric of science in the larger field of science studies, I think, is another question. And I think we haven't been quite as successful at that argument, at persuading people that we have something to say to historians of science, philosophers of science, and sociologists of science. We've been trying to make that argument for a while, but I don't know that we've been making it in the right venues or been making it in the right way. I think we're going to continue to try and make that argument. And then, of course, there's the question of how do scientists respond to the kind of work we're doing. And, you know, there was, of course, the Sokol hoax, which wasn't against rhetoricians, but against the type of studies, science studies in general. And that's also kind of faded away as a controversy, but the backlash to that is still, we still feel the waves a little bit of that.
In your estimation, what does rhetoric add to the study of science, technology, and medicine?
So in my opinion, what we have is a set of concepts and tools and perspectives, as any discipline does. But the concepts, the tools, the perspectives that we offer allow us to do close readings of texts, of the arguments within texts, and the relationship between those arguments and the response of their audiences. So we have a focus on audience, we have a focus on immediate context. We're good at sort of tracking specific performative traditions or metaphors or common places across time. So we also, I think, are good at looking at the production influences on a text. Basically, we do really good textual analysis. And of course, you know, historians of science would tell you they do close textual readings as well. And they do. They do great close textual readings. But I think that we do it, we have a certain set of tools that they don't have to do that. And we have a perspective that they don't have.
A big theme in this pre-conference was invention.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a word, would you say that invention's at the core of what rhetoric adds to science, in addition to the kind of sensibility and a set of methods? Or is there another term in the rhetorical lexicon that you might identify as being more fundamental?
Yeah, no, I guess invention is fine. It's such a broad term. It covers just about everything. I think one of the things that invention gets you is this idea of agency. And this is, I think, one of the things that rhetoricians can argue and have argued, and I think rightly, that we have to contribute that historians don't as much. And that is the ideology of human agency, as Dilip Gonkar called it, right? I mean, he used that as a bludgeon and said, this is something that that binds us as rhetoricians and makes it so that our work is not valuable. I think that it's something that enriches us as rhetoricians and makes our work valuable. I do remember a conference that I attended, the History of Science Society, and I was on a panel to introduce historians to rhetoric. And Jeannie Fahnestock was on that panel, and so was Alan Gross, I think. And John Jackson was one of the respondents. He was a historian of science who's now become a rhetorician of science. And we were trying to explain what it was that we had to offer. And of course, I went up and I said, well, we offer close readings of texts. And John Jackson was like, no, you don't. We offer close readings of text. You guys do all this, you know, sort of ambiguous look at ideographs. And I was like, no, we do close readings of texts. but what the audience was asking for was what Jeannie Fahnestock could actually provide, the apparatus, right? These figures of speech that have this long history. That's what the historians of science were really most interested in. How can we learn more about how a scientist with training in rhetoric has intentionally used rhetoric in order to make an argument that works with his or her audience? That's focus on intent. It's focus on the classical terminology that we have to provide. That told me that was what we really needed to be offering to historians of science anyway. That was what they wanted to hear, and that's what we had to offer. And yet here we were, you know, we were trying to argue, I think having been burned by Dilip, that, oh, no, we don't adopt the ideology of human agency. Well, I think we should adopt the ideology of human agency. That's one of the things that we have to offer. Not in every case, right? I mean, not stupidly, but with a recognition that the human agent isn't the the hero of the story, that there are influences upon the human agent from the audience, from the culture. I think what we do have to offer is a recognition of how that human agent has invented discourse to persuade an audience.
So I asked you what rhetoric adds to studies of science. What does science add to the study of rhetoric?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I read Randy Allen Harris's position paper for the conference, the pre-conference, and of course heard him talk, and it's I don't, it's not really my subject. You know, when I first applied to graduate school, coming out as I did with my double major in biology and rhetoric, I remember writing on my letter of intent that I wanted to study the rhetoric of science and the science of rhetoric. I thought, oh, it's such a, you know, pleasantly designed anti-metaboly there. Doesn't that sound clever? And then, of course, I got to Northwestern. And it worked, and they accepted me, maybe despite that. I got there, and I started taking classes from Mike Leff, who was explained to me sort of what the humanistic tradition is and how different that is from the sciences. And so I look back now on my use of that same language, the idea that there might be a science of rhetoric, and somewhat ashamedly, because that's not what I've embraced. I've embraced rhetoric as a vital part of the humanities, which really is different from the sciences. I guess I've always been more interested in using theory to critique texts. I'm more interested in the specific case and trying to better understand that specific case, and that's something that I got from my advisor, Mike Leff. And adapting the terminology, the theoretical constructs, where necessary, to make them better able to examine and understand that case and better able to examine other cases. But really, the case is what's interesting to me. Answering questions, the research questions I have to do with the texts, what the texts are doing. And so I'm less interested in developing the theory as theory, separated from those texts.
So what do you see as your biggest contribution to the rhetoric of science? And can you put it in conversation with some of these larger themes that we've been talking about? You mentioned the book that you're working on, or that you just finished working on. Could you talk maybe about your first book?
Yeah, my first book is probably my greatest contribution to rhetoric of science. And probably because of where it was published, I was fortunate to get it published at University of Chicago Press, and I have Steve Fuller to thank for that, because he was one of the reviewers and he spoke up for the book. And so having it published at University of Chicago Press, it's a very good press, I think was really helpful. And then it was a good press also in that they were able to get a review of the book in Science Magazine by Richard Rorty. And it was a positive review, so it came in, it was funny, it came in, you know, just a couple of weeks before my tenure case was to go to the department. So it was perfect kairos, right? Mm-hmm. Perfect timing for me. But I think also it was helpful to the field, because it was introducing rhetoric of science to scientists, people who read Science Magazine, and from Richard Rorty, someone who's very respected in the philosophy of science. So, yeah, I don't know, it was my contribution, I guess, but it was sort of a fortunate set of affairs that I think helped make that contribution something that had an impact.
And could you talk about the argument of that book?
It's completely different from the work that I'm doing now. I was looking at interdisciplinary scientific discourse, so I was looking at not sort of the internal discourse of scientists, but scientists speaking to other scientists in other disciplines. And I wanted to argue that there was a type of text that did this, that made a motivational appeal to cross-disciplinary boundaries. And the book argued that a technique for doing this, a rhetorical technique for motivating interdisciplinary activity, was polysemy, strategic ambiguity being an example of that, where you have an appeal that can be interpreted differently by two different audiences, audiences that have very different interests. And positively, if you can have them interpret it so that each of them thinks that it supports their interests over the other, then you can motivate them to come together and work together. So that was my greatest contribution, and polysemy is the concept that came out of that, or theory that I then further developed out of that. And then, of course, the method of criticism that I used in that book, this idea of close textual, intertextual analysis, where I look not only at the text, but the reception of the audience, I think was also a contribution that I made that others have found useful. And then more recently, the manufactured scientific controversy piece, I'm hoping that'll have an impact. It at least has been somewhat controversial, which is what I hoped it would too, that there would be some conversation about the Isocratean approach to rhetorical criticism that I proposed in that article, that we adopt a more sort of pro-science stance, but, you know, in the interest of developing better scientists as better citizens and citizens as more informed about science.
So thinking about the future here, the rise of the internet is inviting a lot of communication scholars to sort of revisit our received theories. How might we account for the impact of internet-worked media on the relationship between science, technology, medicine, and their rhetorics?
Oh, there's a lot of interesting work that can be done on that. I haven't been doing it myself. I'm giving a paper later in this conference about that sort of further develops some of the arguments that I made in the manufactured controversy piece. I want to look at how controversy is played out in the public sphere around scientific issues that scientists don't think are controversial, but that certain skeptical scientists, sort of a minority of that group, along with political actors, would like to make controversial. And I found that a lot of times this controversy is played out in the blogosphere, right? I mean, we have such a such targeted media nowadays. We don't all watch the same channels, and so that creates the possibility for people to experience completely different worlds. You read the New York Times and listen to NPR, and you think climate science is clear and obvious, and there's no question about the science itself. You watch Fox News and, you know, read What's Up With That blog, and you think climate science is a crock, right? And those two worlds are completely separated, and I think it's partly due to the internet providing. Well, and also sort of our media universe expanding with cable television. But I think that's something that I'm finding of interest. And how do you do research when you have these two communities that are so divided? It's a partisan press that we're facing. And part of the reason for that is our access, easy access to sources of information on the internet. So I don't have any answers, but I think that's an area that's worthy of further study.
And are there other directions, other exigencies or topics or methods that you see as a kind of future for research in this field?
Well, I mean, I think that when we started, we were looking at the hard case. Scientific texts. We needed to argue that scientific texts were rhetorical, that they could be analyzed by rhetoric. And you could get published by just showing that this text is rhetorical. I think that now that we're secure, that we've proved that, we've done that, been there, done that, that we really need to look more at what seems like the obvious subject for rhetoricians to take on with respect to rhetoric of science, which is public controversy about science. So that's why I've made my own move away from looking at the internal discourse of science to looking more at the relationship between science and the public. So I think that's a place where we need to go, where we are going, and we will continue to go. And then, you know, I like some of the suggestions that I heard at the pre-conference. I know visual rhetorics of science are hot, just as visual rhetorics are very exciting now, probably because of things like the internet. We don't have, I think our language, our tools will need to be readapted for looking at visual rhetorics of science as opposed to verbal rhetorics of science. I think our tools are really good at looking at verbal rhetorics, and will have to be adapted, continue to be adapted to looking at visual rhetoric. So I think that's really, really interesting. I support the move to looking at international rhetorics of science. I haven't really done much of that myself. My book is, my second book that's about to come out is a focus on American rhetoric. I mean, it's looking at an American culture type. And so I was just thinking this morning about how it would be really interesting to see how that that metaphor of the frontier, if it actually appears outside of the American context. It's not something that I really looked at in that book, so that may be a further line of research that I could develop since I've been persuaded that this is an important subject to look outside our national borders. So those are some areas that we should develop. I'm teaching a rhetoric of science graduate course this quarter, and a lot of my students are doing medical rhetorics of science, and I think that that's something that we also see Arst doing more of, not just rhetoric of science and technology, but rhetoric of science, technology, and medicine. Technology, we haven't really done very much of rhetoric of technology. I think that there are other interest groups at NCA, other places where people who do studies of technology, communication technologies especially, go, and so we haven't really done much with rhetoric of technology. I don't know if we will. I don't hear a real push for that. I know we had a rhetoric and technology, one of the groups that were at the pre-conference, the Octavian roundtables, and I didn't get the sense that there were a lot of people doing that kind of work. But rhetoric of medicine is a very healthy, large group, and that tells you, I think that may be an area that will continue to develop. And environmental rhetorics, I think we've lost some people who have done environmental rhetorics because they go meet with the environmental communication group now. But the work that I see that being done in environmental communication from a rhetorical perspective anyway, could just as easily be counted as rhetoric of science.
Our final question is, what kind of advice would you give to a budding young researcher in the field, a grad student maybe who's considering dipping their toes in the rhetoric of science waters, or someone who's been turned on to the field in some way? Are there one or two things that you would?
Well, I'd say, do it, join, because the work is just being, it's getting published. It's getting published in our journals. It's getting published in other journals. It seems like it's just a very healthy, strong area. You look at the number of people giving papers in rhetoric of science, not just in the rhetoric of science, the ARST interest group sponsored panels, but in other panels as well. I mean, I just think that there's, in our world, science is very important, and I really appreciated one of the arguments made at the pre-conference that the humanities are under siege, but rhetoric of science is actually the place where it's sort of a growth industry in this time when the humanities are under siege, and we may just be the survivors. As scientists look to the humanities to help them understand how their own discourse is working. So I say, join up, make connections to people, to scientists, and to those doing science studies work in other fields, history of science, philosophy of science. That's what I tell my grad students. They have to take courses outside of, they need to learn rhetoric. They need to learn that as a foundation. But then they also need to take a history of science course or a philosophy of science course if they're interested in bringing in philosophical concepts or if they're interested in looking at historical texts.